So we see roll for this.
Om Parthaya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaita Mrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamanu Santadami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadveshini. Yet to Krishna Vade Kasmin Karye Sakta Mahetukam Karye Sakta Mahetukam Atat Tvartavar Alpamcha Tat Tamasamudahratam Yet to Krishnavat Ekasmin Karye Saktam Ahetukam Atatvartavat Alpam Cha Tat Tamasam Udahritam. And we're talking about jnanam. We've done jnanam, knowledge. Sattvika jnanam, rajasik jnanam, right? Sattva, rajas, and tamas, tamasik jnanam. So now tamas. What? Because we're with all of these, Krishna now is going through right now. What is jnanam? Sattva, rajas, tamas, versions of jnanam, types of jnanam. Then we'll do the karta, the doer, types of jnanam, the karma will do, and then the doer, or the karta, and then the karma, I don't know which one goes first. Karma and then karta. Sattva, karma means the action itself, and then karta means the one who has the doership. All of these are for the mumukshu, not for the jnani. The mumukshu and the jnani are very, very close in terms of karma yoga, as we'll see. But doing this type of refinement allows you to really, in your mind, it's a real discrimination of viveka that allows you to kind of recognize which guna is motivating. What's the motivating guna in reference to what you're doing? As the karta, as the doer, as the action itself, you know, as the jnanam that's motivating? What's the underlying jnanam, knowledge that's involved there? Is it a sattvika, rajasa, or tamasic jnanam? Swamiji talks about this in his commentary. Doing this type of viveka discrimination just refines your mind. You know, he uses the example like in one hue of color, there are many different colors and all of these colors have different names. Once they're named, they become something which you're conscious of. Right? Otherwise, it's just all blue. But there are many, many, many shades of blue that once they're named, you recognize. Like that with these karma and karta, jnanam, these are shades. You know, there's different motivating factors. It's in reference to the guna that's involved in that particular manifestation. To recognize that is really helpful because what we're at really after in terms of our own motivation is sattva, sattvika jnanam, or the sattva in terms of the karma, or sattva in terms of the karta. Because sattva really is antakarana shuddhi. When the sattva is predominant in the antakarana or in your motivations, that is antakarana shuddhi. Right? And so the rajasa and the tamasa motivations or colorings are something that we want to pull back from in terms of gaining an antakarana, gaining a mind that is really can ungain this knowledge and abide in it. So that's why so much emphasis is being put on here, put on all this, according to Shankara in his commentary, and Swamiji writes about in his commentary. So here, we're on the third type of jnana, the tamasic type. So he says, yet two, you'll see this throughout, two differentiates from the other two that we've done. Two means whereas, but, right? But the tamasic jnana, that knowledge which is tamasic, right? That type of knowledge, that which is called, so tet tamasam udaharatam, that knowledge which is named, udaharatam, which is named or called tamasam, what is that like? That type of knowledge is that type of knowledge where the sakta, or the attachment is on one karya, ekasmin karya, on one karya. I'll tell you what karya means in a minute. The attachment on one karya, as though it is Krishnavat, as though it is everything. That is the one thing. That is the one most important thing. That one thing is everything. Now, the one karya, the word karya, as opposed to karanam. Karanam means a cause. Karya is an effect. All of these things that we experience in the world are karyas. They're effects. This body is considered a karya, an effect. Karya karana sangata, where the karanas are considered the sense organs, the sukshma sharira, or the karya is considered this physical body. But any effect is a karya. So that means any object that exists within Maya is a karya, it's an effect of the Maya, okay? Manifestation of Maya. So here, what it says, that jnanam, which is attached unto one karya, as being Krishnam, as being the whole, as being that which is the most important, being everything. That's it. What Shankara says, yet to jnanam krishnavat, it's as though the whole, he says, samastam, that one thing is everything. Like, for instance, what if I took one value that I have? What if I take money? The most important thing that there is, the one thing that is everything, is money. Because without money, I'm nothing. Money is the one most important thing. Or I say the most important thing, the one thing that is only, really, of all things, the one thing that is everything, is this physical body. Because without this physical body, I don't exist. So this is Krishnam. This one thing is everything. Or, and Shankara goes in this direction, there are many, many deities, there are many devatas, but the only one that is the real one, right, is Krishna. Mm-hmm. Swamiji uses that example. What he says is there's one very famous, very sacred mantra, which unfortunately has been denigrated by the Hare Krishnas, because we don't understand them. They're always going around singing Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. But this particular mantra goes like this: Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Rama is an avatar. He came first. There's many avatars, but of these two, between Rama and Krishna, Rama came first, and then Krishna came. So this is the mantra: Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. But the Krishna Bhaktas won't chant it in that way, even though that is the mantra, because Krishna should come first. So, Hare Krishna, like that. Because no other god should come before Krishna, because Krishna is the one and only God. You know? We had that, so in Christianity it's starting to break down now, but there's Jesus, Christian God, Jesus, is the only God. And in order for you to go to heaven, you must believe in Christ. If you don't believe in Christ, then you won't go to heaven. And so it's really the job and the duty of every Christian to convert everybody else so that they can also go to heaven. That's Thomas Ignanum. When in this creation, one thing stands out as though it is samastam. Samastam means everything. Krishna means everything. For something to be samasta, that means that everything, all values, funnel into this one thing. So he says, the saktam, this Thomas Ignanam, is when there is attachment to only one karya, ekasmin, means one, eka. Ekasmin karya, only to one karya, to one thing. One thing means sort of an effect, one thing that is here. As though it was as though it's Krishna, as though it's everything. And that is hetukam, it's a hetukam. Hetu means a cause or a reason. This is actually a haitukam from hetu, a haitukam. It means it doesn't make any sense. There's no logic. There's no logic to support it. It's only a belief. It's a belief that you yourself can't substantiate it. It's just that you know this is true, this is the truth, and this is how it is. How can you say that? Because that's our belief. That's what we've been told, and that's the belief. That's what the scripture says. Or whatever we say about it. That's my experience. That's what I hold to be true. And so you can't logically validate it. It's a haitukam. And yet you still have your sakti, your attachment is only to that. And then he says, it's also a tathartavat. It's something which doesn't possess any truth. Atatva means artha. Atatvartha. Atatva means truth. Atatva means it has no truth. Upon analysis, it doesn't hold, it won't stand. So it's atatvartha. And not only that, it's alpam. The reward that it gives is small. A very small reward. And such knowledge, he says, is what we call tamasa. It's tamasa jnanam. It's something that is not reasonable. It's something that won't stand inquiry. It doesn't make any sense for one thing in the universe to be everything. You know? For one object in the universe to be God. Even if you take a devata, and you say this devata, this particular devata, like man in heaven, like maybe the Christian God concept, a man in heaven who is the creator of the creation which already is there because he's a man in heaven. That doesn't make any sense. Swamiji tells a joke about this. I'm not saying getting into the depth of Christian theology. I'm talking about a layperson's understanding of it. We can say the same joke in reference to Krishna or in reference to anyone who becomes a god in heaven. So Swamiji tells this joke. I've probably heard it 100 times. A little boy says to his mom, "Mommy, who created the world?" "Well, God created the world." Where was God when he created the world? "Well, God was in heaven when he created the world." "Well, who created then the heaven? Who created the heaven?" "God created the heaven." "Well, where was God before he created the heaven?" "Oh, for heaven's sakes, he was in hell." That's Swamiji's joke. "He must have been in hell. Be quiet, son. Be quiet. He was in hell. Where's he going? Where are you going to place him? If God's the creator of the world, and God lives in heaven, then who created the heaven? It's a good question. But when you start analyzing these, when you start applying your reason to a lot of the things that we think, then it will fall apart. Something that's true, should be able to withstand any amount of inquiry. If it's not true, it will definitely fall. At some point, it will fall. That's why, if something is true, you should have the freedom to inquire. Because if it's true, then let it prove itself to you. Right? We're used to something being just a belief, where we're not allowed to inquire because there's no way to know. And so we've been raised spiritually or religiously that the religion is a belief. It's something that you take on faith. And it's not meant for you to know or meant for you to understand. You can inquire into math. You can inquire into science. You can inquire into your experience within Vyavahara. But you can't inquire into your religious belief because there is no way to know. You have to take it on faith. And that's how most people in the West have been brought up with that as a truth. And so what happens when all of a sudden you're allowed to inquire? We don't know that we're supposed to be able to inquire in this realm. That's a matter of thinking. In fact, for a lot of Westerners, instead of inquiring, and yet we're viewing things in an Eastern way, or we're going into an Eastern way of understanding, we interpret things that, in such a way, interpret some of the scriptures or some of the things said in the Upanishads in such a way that it rules out any type of inquiry. Like, for instance, the self, this is all translation, the self is beyond the mind. Which then we think, well, right, the mind has to be shut down. The mind cannot be used to inquire. Right? So the self is beyond the mind, so what do we have to do? Shut down the mind so that we can recognize that which is beyond it. It's another thing that validates, okay, the mind is not something to be used. The mind is not something to be used to validate the vision of the Upanishads, where in fact the exact opposite is true. What is being taught should be able to withstand any amount of inquiry, and the inquiry will only go on validating more and more and more deeply. And if you run into a boulder in your inquiry, you should say, okay, here's a boulder. This boulder, maybe my relationship with this knowledge will live or die based upon this boulder, this blockage in terms of my understanding. So Swami just talked about it. He said, well, if that blockage is there, then you should go for it. You should go for it completely to resolve that blockage. Because if you have come upon a understanding that will negate what the Upanishad is saying, then let the Upanishad fall. Because what are you after? For us, we're after truth. But here, what he says, if it's a tamasic jnanam, it is etatortavat. Any amount, the arta, the meaning itself, upon inquiries, atatva, it won't stand. Tatva means the truth. Atatva means it's not true. It won't withstand the inquiry. Haitukam, it won't withstand reason. It's not reasonable. And the reward you get is opa, is very, very small. Right? There's no karya. Nothing that's an effect within the creation means a part to the whole, right? Something that is an effect that comes into being, right? Itself cannot be the whole. We can't give it that stature of being everything because it's not everything. It itself is an effect. It itself has been born. It itself has been produced. And so it's impossible for it to be the whole. And yet we give that importance and stature to something that has actually just been created. And that requires a certain lack of thinking, an extreme, a real aviveka, a lack of inquiry. What's sad is when the very culture cultivates that lack of inquiry. And so without thinking, you're raised in that dullness, in that tamasic jnanam. People inquire anywhere and get out of it. So that's what he calls the tamasic jnanam. Next we go into karma, sattva, rajas, and tamas, or karma. Karma means the action itself, right? Any type of action. So he says, niyatam sangarahitam, niyatam sangarahitam, aragadvaishatakritam, aragadvaishatakritam, apala prepsuna karma, apala prepsuna karma, yet tat sattvika muchate, yet tat sattvika muchate, niyatam sanga rahitam, araga dveshataha kritam, apala prepsuna karma, yet tat sattvika muchate. This niyata karmas are the karmas that are enjoined upon you. Or the karmas that are enjoined, the nitya naimittika karmas. The nitya karmas, this is just very Vedic culture. Nitya karmas and naimittika. Nitya karmas, the ones that are daily karmas. The things that you're expected to do, like in India, you would be expected to do the Agnihotra karma. It's like a fire ritual. Certain prayers that you're expected to do daily. These are called the nitya. Nitya means always, continually. You're doing these particular karmas, nitya karmas. The naimittika karmas are karmas that you're occasionally called upon to do. Like, for instance, if you have a parent has died once a year on the anniversary of that death, you'll do what's called a shraddha karma. Right? When a child is born, there's different karmas along the way as the child grows up. When the child has its first tooth, when the child says its first word, there's different karmas that are done. When the child's 7 years old, it goes through an upanayana ceremony to bring it kind of into the, you know, the Vedic fold. So there's many karmas that are enjoined at particular times. So for us, when we don't have them spelled out in this way, the nitya naimittika karmas are those duties. Swamiji will say it like this, the duties, those things that are obviously duties for us to do in our day-to-day life. We're called upon to do these things. Those are our nitya karmas. And at other occasional karmas that come up that we're called upon to do, things that is our duty to take care of. And it's actually quite clear that it is our duty. So just like the nitya naimittika karmas are clear duties, we ourselves have clear duties. And when we are not living up to those duties or doing those duties, we'll feel some hesitation or some guilt. So the duties that are obvious for us, these things need to be done. We're called upon to do it. Those are the nitya and naimittika karmas. So if we have to translate this into our life, this is one way to translate it. So those, and then Swamiji makes a statement here. The fact that we're talking about karmas, actions, things that we're meant to do, means we're talking as a karma yogi. All of this is meant for the karma yogi, not for the jnani. For the jnani, the jnani will also be doing all of these actions, but it'll be effortless because the Atman itself is not really doing anything at all. This is all just Ishvara. And so what is being called upon for me to do is just simply what I do. Because the raga dvesha, or my likes and dislikes, preferences, I'm not trying to become whole or trying to become complete, trying to become a happy person in this world. I'm not trying for that anymore. I found the source of the ananda. My mind is abiding there, and I'm living this life I was equal. So it's very natural. But for the mumukshu, The mumukshu who is gaining this knowledge, though that is the aspiration, that is the known aspiration, and that's what I'm putting myself through on a daily basis through list shravana, manana, nididhyasana, so that I can really gain that knowledge. Until I gain the knowledge, my life is, as a karma yogi, is focused on my relationship to the world as Ishwara. That kartritvam, that doership is still there because it hasn't resolved. My knowledge hasn't, it's not complete, it's not mature yet. And yet, I recognize all of this as Ishwara, and my relationship to the world is one that really of bhakta to Bhagavan. And so, with that, I focus on what I am being asked to do, what the situation asks me to do. Right? I'm not deciding what to do exactly. I'm doing what is given to me to do. Those are the niyata karmas. That is my focus. Right? And so I do those sangha rahitam. These niyata karmas I do without attachment. Right? Because I'm not doing them to gain punya or papa. That's a big thing. When they say sangha rahitam, what they mean, I'm so attached, let me do this and let me do that so that I can get, you know, so that I can accrue punya and not accrue papa. Because I want to go to heaven, or I want to get a better next birth. That's not my motivation. My motivation is to do these karmas because they're there to be done. That's what I'm called upon to do. That's different than saying I'm doing this so that I can accrue some punya so that I can go to heaven. So without sangha rahitam, raga dvesha, dveshataha kritam, these karmas are krita, they're done without raga dvesha. In other words, they're not motivated by raga and dvesha. I'm not doing the karma because I want to, because I'm driven to, because that will make me happy. I'm also not doing the karma because dvesha, because I don't want to, out of hatred. Or I'm doing a karma. Raga means I'm impelled positively. Dvesha means I'm impelled negatively. Right? I'm doing, so here, the karmas I'm doing are limited. I'm doing the things that are there for me to be done. I'm doing my duties. I'm doing the sangha rahitam without attachment and not motivated by raga dvesha. Yeah? Apala prepsuna. These karmas are apala prepsuna. I'm not doing it for a desire to accrue apala. This one also is like punya and papa. Somebody within the Vedic fold who's what we call a karmata, who's doing all of the enjoyed karmas, all of the upasanas, all kinds of different rituals. These upasanas and rituals are karma and karmas are being done for punya so that I can get a better next birth and go to particular heaven worlds also. I do it very religiously for punya. And the punya is something like money. It's something that I'm accruing. I'm accruing punya so that I can get a better next birth and I can go to a heaven world. But here, for a mumukshu, for a mumukshu, the karmas are really being done for antakarana shuddhi. That's why, that's when we say, it's not that there's an attachment to doing this karma or that karma so that I can get something. It's not about getting something out here. It's about being in the world in such a way that my mind enjoys relative shanti. That my mind enjoys the shanti that a jnani naturally enjoys. Because for a jnani, this is a non-issue. I'm not looking to gain something from the world. Where the mumukshu, it's more of a discipline, it's a commitment. And that this way of living in the world gives a shanti, which will become natural to me when my mind is enjoying myself, the ananda of myself, of my being. If I'm happy, then I don't have to do anything to become happy. If I'm whole and complete, I'm not driven to do anything to become whole and complete, because I am whole and complete. I'm not talking just intellectually, I'm talking about my own nature. I am whole and complete, I am full. It's like if you've eaten a big meal and you're full, then you don't have an inclination to eat a big meal, right? Because you're full. You had your meal, you're completely full, and this moment, you really don't want or need another meal, not because you don't like food. It's just not necessary. It's not something that I'm impelled to because I'm already full. So at those times when you're full and happy, you actually, there's no inclination to disturb that. And so whatever, I'm completely happy here with all of you, and so why would I not want to be here with all of you? I want to be here. I don't want to be here with all of you because I'm not happy here with all of you. But what if I'm completely happy in the situation? What if my wholeness and my completeness, my well-being, my ananda, my mind has thoroughly recognized and discovered, right, is my own nature that actually doesn't exist out here on an object. It's the self of every object. It's the non-dual being. It's the very being of every object. It is the very being which is me. And so say my mind has gone through all of the rigmarole that it has to go through to work out all of its likes and dislikes, to do all of its inner child work, to get rid of all of the ways of being, ways of thinking that keep the mind projecting its ananda on the world and running around trying to find it. What if I found it? Then what is going to impel my mind to do anything? Actually, what impels your mind to do anything is the prarabdha karma. What that means, what's really impelling your mind to do something is not jiva srishti. It's not the jiva's creation. Oh, I want to do this. It's not ajnanam born. It's not born of ignorance. I want to do this so that I can be happy. I want to get rid of that so that I can be happy. These are all motivators, you know. Ananda is the great motivator. Even it'll take me toward things and away, and both toward things and away from things. What about when actually my mind has really discovered that I am the ananda? Then it stays home. Why shouldn't it stay home? It stays home, and then what? If your eyes are open, you know, then you're located where you are. As ananda, the whole being, you are where you are. And that's fine. Why would you want to be somebody someplace else? For what? Well, maybe because your prarabdha needs you to go there. Other than that, what? It's not going to be jiva srishti, the creation of the jiva, you know, the ajnanam born jiva srishti. It's Ishwara Srishti. The prarabdha karma is Ishwara Srishti. Remember these two terms? Let me just make sure. These terms need to become like English for you if they're not. Ishwara Srishti means vyavahara, this creation. Ishwara's creation. Srishti means creation. So this creation is Ishwara Srishti. It includes this body, your mind, your sense organs, all of the faculties that you have as this body, and this world that you enjoy through your sense organs. This creation is Ishwara. Jiva Srishti is all of the fantasies in your mind, right? Ajnanam born fantasies, the ones that are problematic. I need this to be happy. Seeing a snake on a rope, dream, imaginings. These are all the jiva srishti. Right? And so the jiva srishti, especially ajnanam born, ignorance born, creation of the jiva, you know, is what projects ananda onto this object, and ananda onto this object, and sorrow onto this object. So whatever dukkha is projected over there. And so I have a nivritti, I go away from that. This is all jiva srishti. Sukha is over there, happiness is over there. I have a pravritti, I go toward that. The jiva is because of ajnanam, ignorance, is running around this planet, running around the universe, all of the different lokas, running after sukha, pleasure, all projected. I want that. And running away from dukkha, sorrow, all projected. As those are, there's this object can cause dukkha, and this object can give sukha. No, it does. It's not true. But I, for it not to be true, I have to be able to see through the projection. I have to be able to recognize, to see through a projection. Like for instance, the snake is a projection of the rope. To get rid of the snake, I have to see the rope. Otherwise, it's just a belief. Oh, there's not really a snake there. There's a rope. I saw the snake. No, there's really... I saw the snake. Okay, come on. I'll show you the rope. You have to see the rope. The same situation here. You have to recognize firsthand the ananda that is your own being in order to pull back the projection. Otherwise, it's just a belief. That there's a big ananda inside that I have to discover, but I'm sorry, I haven't discovered it yet. Till I discover it, it's not going to have, it's not going to be something that I can live by, because I don't have that experience. I have the experience of the ananda being out there, and so that's what I do. But as I gain this knowledge, as a form of mukshu, you start to realize this ananda is continually dripping off the objects. I go after the ananda, get the object, right? I go after the ananda that belongs to that object, I end up with the object without the ananda. I have a moment of ananda, but then I get this object that doesn't have any ananda. Go on, lifetimes, beginningless lifetimes, chasing this illusion and being just forever disappointed. Yeah, until one time it dawns on me and I start to think about it. And then I become a mumukshu. And then when I become a mumukshu, you know, and I expose myself to this knowledge, I start to understand. But there's a habitual ignorant behavior. And so this is where the karma yoga comes in. Because I know, and yet my mind keeps projecting the ananda. So what do? I focus on just the niyata karmas. Those karmas which are there to be done. Right? I do those karmas. I do it without any kind of attachment. Attachment means I'm not asking for anything for doing those karmas. I'm doing the karmas because they're those actions because they're my duty. They're there to be done. I'm not doing them motivated by raga dvesha. I need this to be happy. I've got to get rid of it. That's not the motivation. I'm doing the karmas really with an ishvara arpana buddhi, a devotion to Bhagavan. Just let me follow Dharma. Let me follow Dharma. It's not about punya or papa. It's about doing these karmas for the sake of antakarana shuddhi. That's considered satuta. Or a mumukshu. And this attitude is natural for a jnani because you've recognized yourself as ananda. Once you're on ananda, even in samsara, those moments when you are happy, there's nothing you want to do. You're happy. The only thing that'll happen to you is you'll start being afraid that somebody's going to take it away. But when you're happy, then you just want to be happy. And you're all fine. Because in your presence, I am happy. So that's a good thing, right? So we experience that. You don't run away from happiness. You don't run away from wholeness. When you're whole, you just want to be with that wholeness. That's it. You know? And that's the state of ajnani. So that means that jiva srishti, when you are whole, when that's your experience, the jiva srishti is quiet. Mm-hmm. When for Ajnani, those moments of wholeness, the Jiva Srishti really starts vibrating because of fear of losing it. All of these things, how can I keep this, and now what can I do to make it better, and all these things will start vibrating. But not for Jnani, because the wholeness never goes away. The wholeness of the Atma never goes away. It's ever-present. It doesn't matter what the vritti is. And so the mind starts resting in that wholeness. So when my focus as a mumukshu is on just doing my duty, I'm not paying attention to raga dvesha. It's not about attachment. It's not about collecting. It's not about collecting punya or papa. It's just about Ishwar Srishti. Let me stay here in Ishwar Srishti and keep bringing the Jiva Srishti back to Ishwar Srishti. And it's a very beautiful, powerful sadhana. So he's saying, this is what. Remember, this. All of this teaching is for the mumukshu. It's important. That's important to understand. This is the sattvika jnanam, which is what we're looking for as mumukshus, this particular attitude. So now he goes to the rajasa, number 24. Yattu kame psuna karma sahankarena vapunaha sahankarena vapunaha kriyate bahulayasam kriyate bahulayasam tadrajasamudahritam tadrajasamudahritam yet tu kama ipsuna karma sahankarena vapunaha kriyate bahulayasam Ted Rajasam Udaharitam. That karma, that type of action that is called Rajasa, and that yet to, whereas that, the two is whereas that act type of karma that is called Rajasam is that which yet, is that karma which is done kama ipsuna, with a desire for the kama. Kama here means, kama also means desire, but it means desired object too. So the kama is the thing that you desire. So the rajasa karma is a karma that is done with a desire for whatever the desired object is. That's the motivating factor. I want this so that I can be happy. Or I want to get away from this so that I can be happy. That's the motivator. That's the desire for that karma. Or it's also sa ahankarena. It's done, the karma itself is done with arrogance. Here the ahankara means arrogance or pride. I do this, I am the one who is doing this karma. Even if I'm doing a niyata karma, what makes the niyata karma, this enjoined karma rajasa, is that boastfulness around doing it. I'm a great person for doing this karma. It's an arrogance. That arrogance of wanting, taking pride in the karmas you're doing, as though it pumps up your ego. So those karmas that are done either with a desire for the karma, for the desired object, or they're done with arrogance, and bahulayasam, they are done in such a way of making a great effort. You're doing great effort out of what you're doing. This is bahu. Bahu means a lot. Bahula ayasam. Bahula ayasam means there's a great effort involved. Great effort along with the arrogance, any kriya that this karma is being done. It's so much work on my part. I've done so many things. I've had to work so hard to make this happen. It's taken a tremendous amount of energy and effort on my part, and yet I've done all of this, and I've been able to accomplish all of this. That's the bahula ayasam. It's a great effort, making a big to-do out of nothing. So tad rajasam udahritam, this type of attitude. There's two things here. One thing is, the motivation is I'm doing this karma because I want something. I have a desire. It's called if any karma you do, there's something that you want. If I go to get a drink of water, I want something. But here it has to do with that's the main motivator. I do a karma for a desired object. It means that for me, the ananda is still totally projected onto the object. Karma yoga is not that way. The mumukshu knows, you know, the ananda is my own being. I know I don't act that way, but I know it. I know I haven't recognized it, but I know it. I see it. I'm not acting that way, but I will in more time. That's the karma yoga buddhi. But the samsari is the one who doesn't know that at all. I try to fulfill my desires so that I can be happy. Here, that's the kama ipsuna. The other is, I do my duties, right? I do my duties to show what a great person I am. That's the sahankarena. I do it arrogantly. And I make a big show about it too. I do it with a lot of splash and effort. So that type of activity is is rajasic karma. Let's do one more. Anubandham kshayam himsam. Anubandham kshayam himsam. Anapekshacha paurusham. Anapekshacha paurusham. Mohat arabhyate karma. Mohat arabhyate karma. Yattat tamasamuchyate. Yattat tamasamuchyate. Anubandham kshayam himsam. Anapeksha chapaurusham. Mohat arabhyate karma. Yattat tamasamuchyate. He says, those karmas which are called tamasa karmas are those that karmas that are done, that are begun, mohat arabhyate karma, he says. Those karmas that are done, not keeping anapeksha, not keeping in view the anubandha, consequences. Like I do an action, not keeping in view at all the consequences of that action, the harm that could come from that action, or I could lose my reputation from doing those actions. If I get caught, I could be put in prison from doing these actions. Consequences of my actions are not taken into account. Also, the kshaya, the losses that can occur, the destruction that can occur from a given karma, not taken into account. Himsa, the pain or the injury that can come about from doing that action. These things are not thought about. And paurusham. Paurusham means my own capacities. I do a karma, I undertake an action. I begin, arabhyate means I begin a karma, I begin an action. Having not considered or taken into account my own capability. Whether I can actually capable of doing that action. Or what qualities I need to have to be able to successfully do that action. These type of things, my own capacity, my own limitations, my own resources, the paurusham, didn't occur to me. Harm that might come from the action, say if I were to steal money from somebody, Swamiji uses that example, so does Shankara, I think. If I were to steal money from somebody, how that might affect that person, let alone me. You know? The anubandha, the consequences, say if I steal something from somebody, it causes great pain for that person who's stolen from, and I don't consider the anubandha, the consequences that might come to me, I might also be put in prison. These type of things are not thought about. Anapeksha means I don't consider them. I don't keep them in view. The kshaya, any type of devastation or loss that might be caused by the action? No. I just simply begin the action. Because moha, There's a delusion in my mind. There's no thoughtfulness in the mind. There's nobody contemplating. There's no viveka. There's just simply dullness. The dullness of just doing an action without considering anybody else or the results of those actions. That's considered tamasa, tamasa karma. Okay. After that, we'll do, next three is the karta, the doer. We'll stop there. Om Om Swasti Prajabhyah Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahimahishaha Go Brahmanebhyah Shivamastu Nityam Loka Samastha Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parajanyah Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho yamsho bharahitaha brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha sarve santu niramayaha sarve bhadrani pashyantu ma kaschit dukha bhak bhavet asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotir gamaya mrityorma amritam gamaya Om purnamadah purnamidam purnat purnamudachyate purnasya purnamadaya purnameva vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Arihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Arihi Om Om.
I have a question about the tamasa one. So I've been learning a lot about gangs.
Gangs.
And especially some of the really bad ones in California. There are people, or they're usually men in these gangs, who they know that what they're doing is bad, and they know that they're going to end up life in prison eventually. At some point, that's actually a goal
world.
For them. Yeah,
it's cruel.
And it's a cruel world, and it's hell. I mean, it's almost inconceivably horrible. And there are people that intentionally do that. And I'm wondering how this relates to that, because this seems like people who they don't realize that there are these awful consequences to themselves and others. But then there are those who do things knowing that there are.
Like people who are working to go to prison, or
they want to end up at Pelican Bay. That's the worst prison in California.
Yeah.
But that's where the power of the gang is, and the leaders are there.
That's moha. That's what we call delusion. That's the moha. You know, I actually saw a long time ago a documentary on this where some lifers in some of these, like San Quentin, some of the worst prisons, they actually brought in some of these young gang leaders into these prisons who had this value for being able to get in there.
Yeah.
You know, they brought these gangs in, and these lifers, who were really rough guys themselves, set these guys down and had a heart-to-heart with them to tell them, you know, it's not quite what they think it is. That's what we, you know, but they have that delusion that this will be cool. We want to get there. That's exactly what they thought in this documentary.
Hmm.
And the lifers that were in there...
perpetrated by the people inside.
What?
They actually intentionally perpetuate that belief. They created a rap video for this one particular gang. I mean, they instill that belief.
Yeah, to make themselves seem cool to these guys.
Well, it's for power, yeah. It's a whole...
Yeah, it's a whole macho
thing. It's brainwashing.
It's brainwashing, yeah. This was not that. This was a group of lifers who are trying to break through that.
Yeah.
But that's right. That's moha. Yeah. Same.
So that would fit into this category.
Well, I don't know if there's...
Or is it a whole nother...
That part would fit into the category. There's this sociopathic thing, though, that's a very sick thing where hurting, they know exactly what they're doing, and they're hurting another person in order to hurt them. You know, this is what's being said here is not that.
Okay.
I don't take it like that anyway. That's for the himsa, you know, you're doing an action without considering the harm that would be done. You know, like say if you steal from somebody, you don't pay any attention. But there's another type of person who does the action to hurt.
Or at least knowing that it hurts.
So is that more...
I would say knowing...
Because they get some sort of pleasure from it? So the goal is their happiness by getting pleasure from inflicting pain on others?
Well, we did this in chapter 17 under kind of another guise when we were talking about rajasic karma, right? Or the rajasic ahankara. It was in chapter 17 where they did spell it out like that. Like a person who, like in a game, where the person would think, this person did wrong to me, and I'll make sure to get rid of them. I'll kill them. That type of thinking was there in chapter 17 under Rajasa. This is a little different what they're saying here. That's not what I read into this.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to find it somewhere else. Because it is there.
It's in the world.
It's just, in the world.
It's so maybe it is more Rajasic as opposed to Tamasic. Is that what you're saying? Or maybe it's a whole other thing altogether?
I don't know. I'd have to think about it. Whether it's going to be Rajas or Tamas, but it's also sick. It's deviant.
You know,
it's really
I read this book recently called, and it's really quite shocking. It's an older book, but it's called The Sociopath Next Door.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And, I mean, I have reason, I'm sorry to say, to read this, and... it just scared the pants.
It's very frightening.
And they were talking about, and I happened to be, I was finishing
I know that
the
book,
book
by
I was
the way.
In a plane, you know. And, you know, they've done these estimates where it's 1 in 25 people who don't sociopath.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them will be violent, but many aren't, but they're still manipulative and they still know what they're doing and they're very skilled at it.
Mm-hmm.
But they were saying 1 in 25, and I looked at the plane and I thought, I called the stewardess, I'm showing my age, called the flight attendant over and said, how many people does this plane have?
You're doing the math.
Yeah. And I went, yeah, I did the math. And I thought, you know, whoa. But that's a little bit different. It's so deviant and so sick that I'm not sure that that's necessarily what we're talking about, you know, that here.
That's social, that's... It's very, very frightening because there's something missing in the mechanism.
Yeah.
They don't experience any type of remorse or guilt. No guilt, no conscience. So, yeah.
They must have had them in India even in those days, too. I'm sure it's not a new thing.
Well, I was kind of shocked when we were doing Chapter 17 that they were actually talking about some of the... It's like the corporations are sociopathic because there's no human there. Mm-hmm. And so their behavior is really, really frightening, and they're running the world, these sociopathic corporations. You know, they're so well described in chapter 17. And there's so many sociopaths in politics now.
I was just going to say that.
You know?
You don't have to worry so much about that ratio on the plane because so many of them are in politics and they're probably not on the plane with you.
In their own private planes.
But what's scary is that you can't reason with them because the mechanism is not working properly.
Right.
You know? They see things totally differently, only for what's good for them, not what's good for you. And there's nothing in them that has this golden rule operating. The golden rule's not operating. Where that's really something that's almost, what do you call it, instinctual. But what if that doesn't operate? You don't think like that. It's not thinking, you don't feel that. You should be feeling that. But what if you don't? Nothing. Ugh, it's creepy to even think about it.
It is, but I think what was good for me, because I was so ignorant of it, was to know. They even say it in the book, you know, you have to be able to recognize and also to protect yourselves and others from some of the hallmarks of it, so you can see, you know, but it is, it's very chilling. Because
it's chilling,
It's like another, it's not even an animal, it's like another being,
monster,
you know, different thing.
Have you ever read Ayn Rand?
I have.
I read it when I was young, years ago when I was young. I looked at it. This is all you have to do now. Because most of us read that when we were teenagers. Now, say you go back and look at that again. Just read like 3 or 4 pages. That's all you need.
Hmm.
So, it's a really amazing.
Alan Greenspan's mentor.
Yeah.
Also Paul Ryan.
Paul Ryan. So many of those people. But if you read her, I was shocked. Because I didn't remember. I was too young when I read it. I thought it was a really neat novel. I read Atlas Shrugged and what's it, The Fountainhead. And it was a very compelling novel. I liked it. But when I read it now, really, 2 pages, that's all.
Mm-hmm.
It's enough. And you feel awful. So it makes you sick.
If you ever see her interviewed live, you know, she's worse than the book.
But it's shocking.
Yeah.
Has anybody read it recently or looked at it recently?
Mm-hmm.
It's really an interesting thing to do.
What's it called?
Atlas Shrugged, or The Fountainhead, either one. And there are people who that book is alive and well, and it's growing again. It's a whole value system, sociopathic value system. I never would have even known about that. I thought it was kind of exciting when I was young. I didn't think about it like that. But this time when I read the few pages, it's interesting.
Could you say more about how the Mumukshu or the Karma Yogi gains a deeper understanding through karmas through doing actions in reference to developing antakarma shuddhi. Because it seems like the antakarma shuddhi is like where the karma yogi gets attraction in a way for the understanding. Is that true?
Well,
it's kind of part of the core development, right, that takes place in the karma yogi through the interface with the world and doing things without having a goal, but doing them in order to gain the antakarma shuddhi.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing, we have to always make one little thing clear. You will always have a goal, right, or you're not going to do the action.
Yeah.
But the difference is that you're not... The motivation behind your actions is antakarna shuddhi. That's why we're talking about duties. These duties are called upon me. The universe is asking me. My karma is asking me to do this. Right? So I'm not doing it because I want it or I don't want it. I'm doing it because this is what is my dharma. So now the thing is, well, how is that, just doing my dharma, how is that going to be helpful? Well, the reason it's helpful is because whether you know it or not, you are the ananda that you seek. You may be totally ignorant that it just happens to be a fact. Okay. So, when you're doing actions in the world, just simply doing your dharma, in fact, as opposed to going after your raga dveshas, your likes and dislikes, in restricting my actions to the dharma, that gives you in the world the greatest amount of shanti. Shanti means peace of mind. Going after raga dveshas in the world is very tumultuous because I need so many things to go right for me to be able to fulfill it. And so many obstacles come along that make me feel irritated or I don't like that person or this or that because they're in my way, basically. But when your actions are restricted to doing what Bhagavan asked you to do in every situation, what means what is your dharma? So what Bhagavan asks me to do, it's kind of anthropomorphizing what is my dharma in this situation. So that's what we mean by this Ishwara Arpanam Buddhi. This devotion to Ishwara is doing my dharma. When I'm doing that, my being is in harmony with the creation. There's no jiva srishti there. There's no jiva creation there. I'm just present to the world doing what is asked of me. So what is present there is Ishwara, without the interruption of the jiva. So that means the mind enjoys shanti. The mind of the jnani enjoys shanti. Right? The mind of the mumukshu enjoys shanti because of dharma. The Ishwara Arpana Buddhi is the practice of dharma. In that shanti, it's like the sun reflecting in clear water bucket. The sun resonates, right? Fills up that clear water bucket with its rays. When my mind enjoys shanti, I enjoy the pola. The pola that I enjoy is the ananda that's manifest in that mind because of the shanti. Right? You see that? If my mind's agitated, then that is creating things that we call, that we label irritation and pain or anxiety. These are all words for different degrees of agitation in the mind. Those are just labels for different types of agitation in the mind. When the mind is quiet, then we have labels for the quiet mind, like feeling love or happiness or joy or compassion. These are just subtle differences between different levels of quietude in the mind. Okay. In the practice of dharma, or this, you know, karma yoga, the mind enjoys that. And when I'm practicing dharma, my mind is pulling away from this raga dvesha, these likes and dislikes, or let me feel this desire, let me fulfill this desire. So what I experience, though, in doing that, just dharma, is much more deeper happiness. And that experience of a deeper happiness is instrumental in letting these raga dveshas fall off. Because I'm actually happier. Right? The experience is more stable. It's a more stable happiness. And very close to what is natural for a jnani. It's natural for you to do dharma as long as the raga dveshas aren't there. That's what's natural. Why you would be inclined to do what is dharmic. Okay? The golden rule. You're inclined to do the golden rule. Because that's sensible and logical.
But that's absent in a sociopath.
It's absent in a sociopath, yeah.
I have a question about Maya, want to understand. So you said that Maya is an incidental attribute of Brahman.
Yeah.
And that is which allows for ignorance to arise. Would that be an okay definition? Duality to be perceived?
Not exactly. Well, maybe, but let me say it in a different way, because your language doesn't quite work for me.
Okay.
Say if we look at Maya as that which is responsible, incidental attribute. By that we mean that it's natural to Brahman, but it brings about no change in Brahman whatsoever.
Right.
So that, but it Maya belongs to Brahman, but because it has no independent being of its own, and it doesn't bring about any change to Brahman, we say incidental attribute. Okay. So Maya is responsible for the manifestation of all duality of the entire creation. Everything that exists within time and space on every level, that manifestation of the creation is from Maya. So Maya manifests, is sustained, and resolves in a cyclical basis from beginningless time according to the vision of the Vedas, of the Upanishads. Now, we call that Ishwara, Brahman, with this incidental attribute Maya, is responsible for this cyclical manifestation of the creation. So for Ishwara, there's no ajnanam, there's no ignorance. There's only, if we look at Maya as being that which projects the creation, for Brahman, that's all it is. Brahman plus Maya with this quality of projection and resolution. That quality of projection is what we call vikshepa. But for those who are within the projection, like you, like all of us, all of the jivas are part of that projection. Like if you have a dream, there's a whole dream world with all of the jivas in it. The jivas are part of the projection. So here all of us are part of the manifestation of the creation. They're that vikshepa, that projecting capacity, which is just the manifestation for Ishwara. For the jiva is also what we call avarana. Avarana means that which covers, right? Because the jiva is limited. And so the jiva with the five sense organs looks out around at the creation. But because of the limitation of the mind, right, it has no way, that mind, its mind stuff, has no way of knowing that the self, of which Maya is an incidental attribute, is its own reality, its own being. How can that limited mind know that? Because the mind enjoys conscious being, but the mind only thinks, I am the conscious being. That's the ajnanam. And that ajnanam needs to be removed. But how can that jiva remove that ajnanam? Because all of its sense organs and all of its means of knowledge only go outward to participate in the projection. You know?
So within the projection or the creation of, creation words, Ishwara manifesting, within that there is my mind manifesting as separate from the whole projection.
No, because your mind is existing within the projection. And within that projection and within the laws of Ishwara, the mind can think and feel and project.
And so,
there's nothing, there's no getting outside of the projection of Ishwara.
But there is a capacity to not perceive the wholeness of Ishwara.
Absolutely. It can't perceive the wholeness.
And that is the problem. That's ignorance.
That's ignorance.
Which we call jiva.
Well, the ignorance is responsible for the jiva. The jiva means that I take myself, which is Brahman, to be this body, mind, sense organs. That ahankara is a result of that ignorance.
Okay, I think I understood. From within the big projection
of Ishwara,
there is a misperception
on the part of the jiva.
And I become, or no, I become, I
take myself to be.
Take myself to be a separate thing.
Yeah, okay. When I'm not really.
Never have been
and never will be.
So Maya is not illusion in this in this sense. It's not a misperception. Maya has nothing to do with a misperception. Maya has to do with the manifestation of creation. It's not misperceiving. It's not
Maya is not the misperception, right. But because of the limitation of the jiva, that same Maya that for Ishwara brings about the manifestation of the entire creation, so it's that creative capacity, that same Maya is the Ajnanam for the jiva.
The Ajnanam is...
ignorance.
The ignorance.
Yeah.
Okay, the same Maya...
That is just a Vikshepa, the creative capacity for Ishwara, also is Vikshepa for the jiva, but also Avarna, Ajnanam.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. So there is the main, I don't know, the main Maya, but the pure Maya, and within...
The whole total Maya.
The total Maya.
Yeah.
And there is a...
Within that Maya manifests as this whole creation, including all of the jivas. But each jiva is limited, right? Limited mind, limited sense organs, limited body. And so because of that limitation, the mind, which has the capacity to think and feel and all of these things, how is it going to know that the consciousness that sits enjoying is the non-dual consciousness of the whole creation? It will just think that the consciousness it enjoys belongs to it.
And that's called Maya as well.
That's Maya, but we call it Ajnanam.
Ajnanam, okay.
Ignorance. Oh, that Maya, that which is Maya for Ishwara is ignorance for the jiva.
Okay, I understand. Yeah. I understand the difference. Okay, thank you.
So we say in some terminology, we say that the Maya, right, has two capacities, Avarna and Vikshepa. Vikshepa is the projecting capacity, means that Maya manifests as a creation. That's the Vikshepa, projecting. It also has the capacity of Avarna. Avarna means to cover. That's the Ajnanam. So for Ishwara, Ishwara only experiences the Vikshepa, the projecting, because infinite. If there is nothing that is not Ishwara. So there's no covering because there's nothing that I'm not. As the Ishwara Upadhi, the conditioning adjunct that we call Ishwara. But what is Vikshepa for Ishwara, for each one of the jiva, for every jiva, even though you all have your own Vikshepa, you can project, you can dream, all of these type of things, you have your own, you know, capacity, but you're subject to Avarna, covering, because of the limitation, right? of the mind, really, the limited nature of the mind.
And this Maya, how does it, I don't know how to phrase this, but how does it originate?
It doesn't originate. Maya is considered beginningless. Just like the Brahman is timeless because no parts. It's not created. It hasn't come into being. Doesn't go out of being. It has no parts. It's just conscious existence, which is consciousness at Chidananda. Okay. Maya is beginningless. We say it's beginningless because it's cyclical. Creation manifests and goes out of manifestation, you know, cyclically. But when did this cyclical creation, when was the first one? When did it first happen? Who would start it? Brahman's not going to start it. Brahman's just consciousness. Doesn't have any arms or legs or anything to start anything. So Maya, as an incidental attribute, has to be beginningless.
And then, who does this Maya belong to?
Brahman. But when we say belong to, that's why we have to bring an incidental attribute. There's nothing but Brahman. So you can't put Maya can't belong to somewhere else. There is nowhere else. Mm-hmm. So we say, okay, Maya belongs to Brahman. Well, what do you mean by belong? Well, it doesn't exactly belong to Brahman, but it's not away from Brahman, because there is only Brahman. So you can't categorize Maya as being something real like Brahman or non-existent. Maya is here. So we can say, okay, Maya is an attribute of Brahman, but it's an incidental attribute. Incidental means it's there, it belongs to Brahman, but it brings about no change to Brahman. That's why Swamiji came up with this term, incidental attribute.
And is that a belief?
It's the test election.
We make a
No, it's not a belief. It's something that upon analysis you see what's meant there.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can say your dream is an incidental attribute because the dream, you have a dream.
Yeah.
It's not somebody else's dream, but it doesn't bring about any change to your being. So it belongs to you, but it doesn't bring about any change.
Could we say that a lucid dream would be a better analogy than just waking up from a dream? Because in a lucid dream, you realize that actually you're not the character, you're not the dream, but it's actually Igor dreaming this thing.
Yeah, and sometimes we use lucid dream, and also sometimes I peek just because of that. And sometimes I like to just use imagination. Because if you use your imagination,
right,
also
right,
you can really understand. Yeah, that's good.
Now, is Ishvara also beginningless?
Or is it Ishvara, Brahman is not beginning. Time, Brahman is timeless, so the truth of Ishvara is Brahman. And then with the Maya Upadhi, you know, if Brahman has the Maya Upadhi as an incidental attribute, as soon as we bring in the Maya Upadhi, we're talking about Ishvara. But who is Ishvara? It's really Brahman, right? Brahman with this Maya Upadhi. Upadhi means conditioning adjunct. Yeah. So Brahman with Maya, we're talking about Ishvara.
So is incidental attribute a phrase that Swamiji chose because it better describes what's going on than conditioning adjunct?
Well, conditioning adjunct is just a word for upadhi.
Okay.
Then you might ask what...
Yeah. I don't know what that means. I still don't.
Well, okay, upadhi is, if I say this body is an upadhi as a conditioning adjunct, what did we call it?
Upadhi.
Yeah.
Conditioning adjunct.
Conditioning adjunct, yeah. Sorry.
It's yeah, that, funny that word just...
Okay,
yeah.
But that's how it's often called. What that means is my mind can take myself to be this.
Oh, I see.
That's what makes it an adjunct. You know, it conditions myself as though I become this.
Something it's a place to hang the projection.
Yeah. Yes. It's something to hang the eye.
Okay.
Like this wouldn't be a conditioning adjunct for me. I don't take myself to be the table, but I take myself to be the body. I take myself to be the sense organs, I see, I hear, like that. I take myself to be the mind, the thoughts in the mind, the emotions. Those are all upadhis.
Why did they choose the words conditioning adjunct? Those words don't, for me, fit with what it is.
I don't know. I think upadhi, the word itself, is hard to find a translation for. And that's just one that's often used. But it won't work unless it's defined. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
That's like saying incidental attribute of Brahman. I mean, it gives me kind of the creeps to say attribute in Brahman. And
yeah.
You know,
but now...
Brahman doesn't have any attributes.
Exactly. And so then you have to go through this whole thing about what does incidental mean. You know? Incidental, it's an attribute. But this all comes because of the question, where to place Maya? Where do you put it? There's no place outside of Brahman, so that should be enough. Well, it has to belong, it has to be there with Brahman. But we should just be able to say it is mithya. If it's mithya, that really defines it, what it is. Brahman is the adhishtana, you know, and Maya is mithya, depending upon Brahman. See, mithya, the word mithya means it has no being of its own. It depends totally, 100% for its being on its adhishtana. The adhishtana is what is actually there. So now say we understand that, then I'll say Brahman is the Adhishtana, Maya is Mithya. Means Maya has no being apart from Brahman, it's Adhishtana.
So Ishvara is Mithya as well.
Okay. Well, when you say Ishvara is Mithya, you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? Because Ishvara, the self of Ishvara, is Brahman. So for Ishvara, we have Brahman plus Maya. So we have the Satyam Brahma and the Mithya Maya. So really, the self—it's like the self of the self of this creation, this Mithya creation—is Brahman. So Ishvara is Brahman with this Mithya Maya. But we're taking into account Maya when we say Ishvara. But who Ishvara actually is Brahman.
And then why do they spend so much time defining Ishvara?
Well, because here we are. And you as a jiva are here amidst Ishvara. Right? Otherwise, you as a jiva are Brahman, but then you're walking through this world that has nothing to do with you. It's very important to recognize that this creation is a conscious being and not an inert mother nature. Then you are the little pocket of consciousness walking around in this inert creation. And you're the only one that knows you're Brahman. The creation itself is just inert. And so you have to make your way then. Instead of recognizing this creation is an infinite mind of which this limited mind is a part.
Mm-hmm. So you can really see the creation as
an you're part of an infinite intelligence. Your limited intelligence is part and parcel of your infinite intelligence. That's the way to really understand it, that this little body-mind sense organs is part of you, yourself, as Ishvara, this infinite intelligence. And so who knows best, you as this infinite intelligence or your mind that is suffering tremendously from ajnanam, from its own limitations? It can't know the whole story.
Yeah.
And so for the jnani, you become more, you listen more to Ishvara. You pay more attention to Ishvara because infinite intelligence.
So the jnani really has the capacity.
Your infinite intelligence, not somebody else's.
Mm-hmm. So the jnani really has the capacity to see everything as Ishvara, everything is sacred, everything coming, emanating, from manifesting from him?
Yeah. This is all Ishvara. A good way to think of it for you as an individual, your prarabdha karma, which includes the not just this body, mind, sense organs, but the entire situation that you move through in life, right? Like your prarabdha karma involves the whole story, not just me sitting here. All of this everything included in this moment is my prarabdha karma. This is what is actually here. My mind can be doing all kinds of fantasy and all kinds. That's the jiva srishti. This is my prarabdha karma. This is Ishvara. This body is Ishvara. The mind is Ishvara. The sense organs are Ishvara. All of the capacities are Ishvara. Everything I experience is Ishvara. This here and now is Ishvara. Right. And so I can see this is Ishvara. And I can also know what I'm called on to do as a jiva. What is there obviously for me to do in this situation? That can be obvious. So what makes it not obvious is the jiva srishti going wild about, but what about this and what about that? And if I did that, and if I did that? And how am I going to make my way? And how am I going to be happy? So Swamiji says, you just do what is here. Just calm down. Do it. Do what is here to be done to the best of your ability. That's all. That's all it is.
So thinking that this is my story is really creating an individual's creation.
Well, if you say...
Because it does feel like my story.
Well, let it be my story, but let the my be Ishvara. Hmm. Otherwise, if you say this is my story, then what you're meaning usually is that I find myself here in this inert creation of these little bubbles of consciousness walking around and doing this and that, they're also in an inert creation, and I have to make my way. And for Jnani, I'm not making any way. This, the way is Ishvara. The way is made. Moment by moment by moment, the prarabdha karma takes you through. And so Jnani will just kind of relax and be with Ishvara. Where an Ajnani will be fretful, of course, because in inert creation, I've landed here and I have to make my way, and whatever I decide is going to be responsible for what happens if all goes well. But that's not, that's just not the drishti. It's not the vision of a jnani.
So if you have a feeling of ownership of your life or of your karma, what do you do with that? How can you say that, oh, just let that go, don't pay attention, it's...
I'm not saying don't pay attention.
Okay.
It's just...
But it's a bigger story than...
It's a bigger story than just you. That you're part of a bigger story. This body, mind, sense organs is part of Ishvara's story.
Hmm.
That's actually very, very rewarding. You know, and it also gives you a different attitude toward life and toward your experiences. Once you think of Ishvara as is you, Ishvara is you,
okay,
as your being, not this body, mind, sense organs.
Okay.
So Ishvara is your infinite intelligence, is a manifestation of infinite knowledge, of which this body, mind, sense organs is a part of that infinite knowledge. Yeah. Infinite complexity. Yeah. And so you can give more respect to the situation you find yourself in, and more respect to see how Ishvara, more interest and respect to see how Ishvara is going to handle it. Instead of thinking you have to handle the whole thing. Because infinite intelligence knows everything. And an infinite being, what is in the best interest of the whole? Now, this body, mind, sense organs is not the whole. Even in this room, none of us are the whole. Right? There are many, many different standpoints, many, many different needs, many different things have to be taken into consideration to make this whole thing run. And so what is the greatest good at any given moment for the whole? And so it's, if you get rid of the kind of the self-centered position and look at it more that way, it can be very exciting and very interesting. You know, to see, if the creation is an intelligent creation, then say you have that as a hypothesis. The Shruti says, the Upanishad said, that this is Ishvara, this is an intelligent, infinitely intelligent creation.
Did that come natural to you when you were exploring these issues? I mean,
well, that's not really a fair question. I don't really think of it like that's something to understand and experiment with. See, if it doesn't come naturally to you for whatever reason or not reason, it's something to this is what the Shastra is saying. And gives a lot of logic and a lot of different things, but in the end you have to see it. So how are you going to see that? Well, here you are. Here the creation is. Here the karma is. Here the situation is. So experiment. Experiment with that drishti, that vision, you know, of looking at this creation and instead of you being the center of it, just look at how the situation is being handled as a whole. And it's easy to do, much easier to do, or easy to do, once your ananda is not at stake. Because the ananda is your very being, it's changeless. Nobody can take it away. So when your well-being is not at stake, then this more egocentric position is not as important, or, you know, you can let that go and see the bigger picture. And that's fun. That's exciting to do that. You know, but you have the freedom to do it because you know your ananda is not at stake. If your ananda is at stake, then you don't really have that freedom, because it's not all right for you not to be whole and complete. That's just not okay. You can't say that it's okay. You'll be bluffing. It's not okay. You know.